Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And I want to give you a little bit of a preface to this. This slideshow actually started about early December. The Board of Trustees at the Forest Society started to engage this whole issue shortly after it was publicly announced in Franklin back in October. And at the time, we had had a little bit of heads up that this was coming down the pike. And the short story is that the board, much like many people who live in communities that are affected, wanted to know more information. So a couple of us on the staff put this slideshow together. It has since morphed. I'm going to probably talk about 30, 35 minutes. And if you have questions while I go along, this is, it's very informal, so you can raise your hand and I'll try to answer them. Or if you want to wait till the end, we can do that too. But basically, what I'd like to do tonight is talk a little bit about what Northern Pass actually is, who it is, what they're proposing to do. Some of this may be repeat information for some of you, but the bottom line is that there are a lot of unanswered questions, and there are some of these questions will only get answered by the research that needs to be done by the regulatory review process. But some of them we need to make certain do get answered, aren't going to be asked during that process. So we're going to go through that a little bit. To start with, if you can't, I'll read basically the information on the slide if you can't read it from where you're sitting. But the project is actually being proposed by two utilities, one called Northeast Utilities from Hartford, Connecticut, and another called NSTAR from Massachusetts. It happens that Northeast Utilities wholly owns all of the stock of Public Service Company of New Hampshire. And these companies got together, formed a New Hampshire limited liability corporation called Northern Pass LLC for the purpose of building this power line, transporting the electricity over the power line, collecting a rental fee from Northern Pass or from Hydro-Quebec for using the power line. And get into a little more detail on that in a second, but the big kahuna here in terms of where is the money coming from is Hydro-Quebec. And we'll talk a little bit more about Hydro-Quebec in a second as well. The project is estimated to cost about $1.1 billion if it's built as proposed. It includes 180 miles of new towers to be erected in the state of New Hampshire, 140 miles from the Pittsburgh-Quebec border down to Franklin would be high-voltage direct current line, and about 40 miles from Franklin to Deerfield would be high-voltage alternating current line. And the proposal that was submitted to the Department of Energy outlining the project estimates that the tower heights will be between 90 and 135 feet. Now, for those of you who don't know much about Hydro-Quebec, and I don't pretend to know a lot, I went to their website back in October, November, and tried to understand what they were and how they do business. And I learned some interesting things. They're the largest utility in North America, number one. They have an installed capacity of 36,000 megawatts, which means that if every generating station that they own was operating full tilt at this moment, they could generate a total amount of electricity of 36,000 megawatts. 98% of this is driven by hydroelectric dams, and they have something like 50 or 51 different hydroelectric facilities around the province of Quebec, most notably on three or four major tributaries that feed into the James Bay. By comparison, the New England wholesale distributor, who's responsible for all six New England states, sold at the peak over the last 5 years. The most electricity they've ever sold is 28,000 megawatts. And so that gives you a scale of how big Hydro-Quebec is. They're bigger than all of New England. Hydro-Quebec has flooded about 7 million acres of land in Quebec in order to create the capacity to generate this hydroelectric power. And that's a couple of million acres larger than the state of Vermont, or maybe the state of New Hampshire. In 2008, according to their own annual report, Hydro-Quebec exported 8% of its total electrical generation, but 22% of its total net income came from that 8% that it exported. So, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that the way they keep their rates low up there is by charging higher rates for the power that they export, whether that's to New England, New York, or other Canadian provinces. Hydro-Quebec's goal, this is their stated goal in their own strategic planning documents, is to export 12% of their total power by 2013, and that's even before this project would come online, which they expect to generate 38% of their net income. So you can see their business model is predicated on exporting some of the excess capacity that they have. As a corporation, they have $60 billion in assets. Very big company. Now, I have to say that 40 years ago, they sat down and did a strategic planning process that led to all of this hydroelectric development. They knew from the beginning what their basic plan was going to be, and they're executing it. And I have to take my hat off to them because they've thought through what they're going to do. They're doing it, and it's working. And I would submit that if the six New England states had done the same thing with the same rigor 40 years ago, we wouldn't be sitting here tonight. This is an example of one of the new hydroelectric facilities they're building on the East Main River, which is one of the main rivers that ultimately ends up in James Bay. And it's just enormous. And this is, like I said, not all 50 other stations are this large, but this project right here will generate, when it comes online in another year or two, about 1,000 megawatts of electricity, which is just about as much as Seabrook Station generates. This is one of the three turbines that will go, I don't know if you can see it, right over here on this section. There are three huge turbines that generate electricity. The water flows through these. I don't know if you can see, but there actually are people standing on the top of this. Just give you an idea how big these things are. They're very expensive to build, but once they build them and they have enough water to fuel them, they pay for themselves in a rather short period of time. Now, this map is going to be a little bit difficult for everybody to see, but I did bring maps if you want to check out afterwards where the route's actually going. The first 40 miles up here in the North Country is scheduled to go through about 40 miles of completely new right-of-way. Needless to say, I think you're all aware that there's a lot of people in Coos County who aren't real thrilled about this. And there was an announcement made earlier today by the project directors or advocates suggesting that they might actually be willing to look at another route to bring this through Coos County. It's not clear where that route might be, but wherever it is, it will essentially be along a new corridor. And that's one thing that I think a lot of people up north, their attitude up there is, this just doesn't belong here, period, wherever you might want to put it. And so the notion that they can somehow just change the location and satiate the objections of people up in Coos County, I think they're not listening. In any event, from Northumberland or Groveton south, it's largely along existing rights of way. This map that was originally published on their website had four or five additional new rights of way that would need to be acquired in different stretches. Today they made the announcement that they would be withdrawing all of those alternative rights of way, and they're going to stick with their original plan. And I told a couple of my colleagues today, basically what they said was damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, and they're going to go right through the White Mountain National Forest, which was their original preferred plan in any event. One of the things that when you look at the map of where this thing is on on the ground, one of the things that's really distressing, at least to us at the Forest Society, is that there already exists a right-of-way. And if for any of you who didn't see the mailing that the Forest Society put out a month or so ago, I brought copies of it, and it has this map on it. But this corridor, whoops, what did I do? Oops, don't know what I did. This corridor right here, the new corridor through New Hampshire that we've been talking about, the Northern Pass Corridor, is very close to an existing corridor which already brings 2,000 megawatts of hydroelectricity from Quebec down through the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont and then through Western New Hampshire. And when you look at this picture, at this map, the first question I asked when I saw this of myself is, why on God's green earth would you want to build a new SCAR all the way through the center of New Hampshire when you already have a SCAR that's capable of carrying the power that you're proposing to create the new SCAR to carry? Now, I talk like I'm an electrical engineer and I know what I'm talking about, and I fully admit that I don't. There probably are some reasons why this existing corridor can't be used or wouldn't be used. One is that it's owned by National Grid, which is a competitor of Northeast Utilities. So if you're Northeast Utilities and you're going to make a whole lot of dough from building a new line, why would you want to split the cost of or split the revenue by sharing it with another utility? But more to the point, if there is a way to physically construct the capacity of the existing 2,000 megawatt right-of-way to carry this new 1,200 megawatts, and it is physically possible to do, if they could figure out a way to do it, it would have a far less environmental impact on the state of New Hampshire if they did that than if they created this new power line and created a new SCAR. So there's a whole bunch of issues that this project raises, and I'd like to cover a number of them pretty quickly here. Happy to talk more if people have questions, but private gain or public benefit. Well, this power line project is being proposed by a private company that's exclusively using the power for Hydro-Quebec, that's not gotten any kind of sanction from the New England grid that this is either needed or necessary for system reliability of the grid. And, the question is, do we need the power? Well, if you're going to assert that there's a public benefit to this, then presumably part of that public benefit would be that there's actually a need for the power. Well, here in New Hampshire, if every electrical generating station in our state were generating electricity at this very moment, we would be producing 4,000 megawatts of electricity. At this very moment, on average, we consume 1,200 megawatts. So clearly, we don't need the power here in New Hampshire. You may remember earlier I mentioned that on the peak day, 28,000 megawatts was necessary to meet the biggest air conditioner load of the summer 5 years ago before the recession hit. That 28,000 megawatts is 5,000 megawatts less than the total capacity of all of the generating stations that serve the New England grid. And so if you add up the differential in New Hampshire, we don't need it here. If you add up the differential for New England, we don't need it there. And I think that the question of whether there is a public need for this project pretty much is answered by those two sets of facts. There's a whole bunch of energy and consumer issues. I'd like to talk about a couple of them. There's a number of economic issues. The applicant talks about property taxes that will be received by local communities, and there will be property tax revenue received by local communities. The city of Franklin, I think one of the reasons why the mayor and other members of the city council are very supportive of this project is because Franklin is where they're going to build this $250 million converter station to convert the electricity from direct current to alternating current. That $250 million facility will generate $5 million a year in tax revenue for the city of Franklin, which is about 40% of the total tax collection in the city of Franklin today. So, I have some sympathy with the mayor and the city council. I understand why it makes sense for them. I will say that they had one of these scoping hearings in Franklin. There were at least a couple 150 people there, and for every member of the city council that stood up and supported it, there was at least one resident that stood up and opposed it. So it wouldn't be a fair representation to say the entire city of Franklin supports this, but it's certainly the only committee where there's any evidence of any support. On the other economic issue, this business about taxation, there's a whole bunch of economic issues that the applicant hasn't addressed. And obviously, they haven't addressed these issues because it doesn't serve the same purpose as talking about the positive benefits from 1,200 short-term jobs and $18 to $20 million a year in tax revenue. But in fact, property values along the line, if you happen to own a piece of land that has the right of way over your property, or if you happen to own property that's immediately adjacent to somebody who has the right of way on their property, your property values are going to decline. In fact, there are, I know people, realtors, who told me just in the area I live in, Holderness, I know realtors in Holderness and Plymouth who've told me they when they have to announce to a prospective buyer that this property might be impacted by this power line, the sale disappears. And that's not a one-time occurrence. Nora? Either one. I think if you're directly impacted, the value, the diminution of value will be greater, but there will certainly be a diminution of value if you happen to look out at it. Right, the existing towers, well, take Holderness for example. It's not in my backyard, it's a couple of backyards away, but I don't live far from the existing right-of-way that they're proposing to use. Those, the towers are actually poles, telephone poles that are 45 feet high. The towers are projected to be 90 to 135 feet high there. The two interesting things there are that that's higher than most of the mature trees grown in the area. And the other thing is these power line, these towers are gonna have to be supported over time. And I think that, you know, I don't know much about electromagnetic fields and all the health issues there, but I do know something about the health impacts of pesticides and herbicides. And there are a lot of people in my town who live right along this corridor who are, even before the talk about this project came up, were very concerned about what the utility company was using to keep vegetation from growing. And so I think that's something we have to pay attention to on this, and that's certainly something that we've argued that the Department of Energy needs to look at in greater detail. So there are a lot of these ecological impacts on forests and land. Obviously, that's a huge concern to our organization. The impacts on scenic landscapes, you know, I've heard a couple of people from public service companies say, well, this is just a bunch of NIMBYs who don't want to look at power lines. And that's true. I mean, we don't want to look at power lines. And one of the reasons people are so exercised about this is because we don't want to look at power lines. And if that's the way we want the landscape of New Hampshire to look for the next 200-300 years, then maybe there are people who support this. But boy, they haven't been very prominent in any of the public discussions.
Could I go back to the spring? Do we have any idea what Hydro-Québec has used in the past?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know. I don't know, but they sure have a lot of power lines they got to keep clear. Susan.
I'm Susan Jimenez. I'm from Houston, and I have land that the PSNH right-of-way for cross. And I dug it up in 1947B, deeded by a previous owner. And it says quite clearly that PSNH has the right only to cut, trim, remove the vegetation. No spraying. So if you have land over which is just the way it goes, dig out that deed somewhere and check the language very carefully.
Now, PSNH did this spray, despite that. Now, Susan raises a really good point. If any of you have land that has a right of way over it, if you're not familiar intimately with the language of that deed, that right-of-way easement, you should become familiar with it because they're not all the same. And when the companies that are proposing this talk about a deeded right-of-way and using existing rights-of-way, they're not all the same because the language in those deeds isn't all the same. And if and there are some people who have deeds that limit the height of towers that can be erected in their right-of-way that they demanded to be put in there presently some 40 years ago. So you need to look at those deeds if you have that issue on your land. Some of the energy questions. One of the big questions that really I find pretty alarming will not get answered in this regulatory review process is whether this is a good investment of $1.1 billion. And by that I mean, the companies are saying, well, this is Hydro-Quebec that's investing this money. It's not ratepayers who are paying for it. If that electricity gets sold in the New England market, New England ratepayers are going to pay for that $1.1 billion. And so this notion that somehow it's a freebie is preposterous. The other thing about that is that if this $1.1 billion were invested some other way, say, for example, in energy conservation measures to reduce the consumption of electricity, what if you could, for $1.1 billion, buy more savings than 1,200 megawatts of new electricity would provide? This question never gets addressed. It never gets answered in this entire regulatory review process. Yet, it's ratepayers who will be paying the cost of building this tower system. Will Northern Pass crowd out other domestic renewables? I haven't talked to one developer or owner of a renewable energy plant, and I've talked to at least 10 in the last month, who think that this will not be, that the consequence of building this line is going to promote better investment opportunities for other renewables. It's just the opposite. In fact, they believe that not only will new development be frowned upon by the marketplace, but existing power plants won't be able to sustainably compete and therefore will just be crowded out. Now, that remains to be seen, but I think it's a concern that those of us in New Hampshire ought to have. Well, the New Hampshire Electric Co-op purchases all of its electricity from other providers, and I don't know how much it purchases directly from ISO New England, but my guess is it's a pretty I'm a co-op user too, but the point is they don't generate any of their own electricity, so they buy, and presumably they're paying very close attention to the price of what they're buying. They don't have a lot of say over what they buy on the wholesale market. That price is determined by these auctions that are held every day. But, the argument that the promoters of this project are making is that this is cheap power. They don't use the word cheap. They usually don't. They call it something like competitively priced power. And I apologize if I'm getting too far into the weeds for people, but this is my version of what competitively priced power means. Hydro-Quebec, which I don't know if this is accurate or not, but I think that the conventional wisdom is that the cost to the power that they're exporting today is between 2 and 3 cents a kilowatt hour. Is anybody here paying that in their electric bill? No, I don't think so. So their cost is 2 or 3 cents. Say they bid into this, they build this power line, they have 1,200 megawatts, they're bidding it into the wholesale market, this which is called the Independent System Operator of New England, which is actually a nonprofit organization that serves all of the consumers and generators and transmitters of electricity in the New England states. And ISO New England's job is to sell power every day to the utilities and the distributing companies that put power to retail customers. So the generators bid in on this daily auction. Hydro-Quebec bids in at 4 or 5 cents. However, the price that all of the successful bidders get paid is the highest price by any successful bidder. So if some generating station bids 7.5 cents, all of them get 7.5 cents, no matter what they've bid in. So if Hydro-Quebec their cost is 2 or 3 cents, they bid in 5 or 6 cents, and they get 7.5 or 8 cents, they get a little bit of a windfall as a result of the process by which these prices are set. So competitively priced power, when you hear those words, They're not talking about reducing our retail electricity costs. They're talking about increasing the windfall that they make on the sale in the wholesale marketplace. So I think it's – now, I'm not going to sit here and say that that doesn't have potentially a positive impact for ratepayers, because it is possible that over time that lower price that they bid in could essentially bring the price of all power down a little bit. That is true. But it remains to be seen how much. And most of the analysis that I've seen suggests that the savings to you and I at the end of the line is cents per month. It's not dollars per month. Sorry, I didn't mean to get so wound up on that. But you know, I think there are a couple other questions we should cover on the energy front. Is there going to be a real reduction in fossil fuel energy generation? And this is a big question mark. There could be, if the effect of this extra power is to essentially make it less economically attractive for a coal plant to come online and sell its power to the grid because their price is simply too high. It could actually keep that plant from operating.
Can I jump in here for 1 second?
Yep.
And speak to this?
Sure.
If you go to the Northeast Utilities 2009 annual report, buried on page 26 is a paragraph where they talk not about Northern Pass, but they actually call it the HQ tie-in line. And there's one sentence that we, New England, are going to sell Hydro-Québec 1,200 megawatts that they are then going to turn around and sell back to us. Now, there is a theory that the demand time in Quebec, because most people in Quebec peak with hydroelectric power. So their peak demand time is in the winter. Our peak demand time in New England is actually in the summer. So it will be a summer flow south of 1,200 megawatts, and then it will turn around in the winter time and go north again to satisfy their peak demand. So the question becomes, where are we going to get the 1,200 megawatts to send back to them? Now, Will has already spoken to the fact that we already produce more than we consume. But to this point, will there be a real reduction in fossil fuel energy generation? I would submit the answer is no, because we're going to have to produce with our existing nuclear, fossil fuel, biomass, the 1,200 watts that we are obligated to send them on this two-way circuit. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
No, a really good point, and very, you've heard very little conversation about that, but it is a two-way street. Should we be concerned about over-reliance on Hydro-Québec for electricity in the northeastern U.S.? Well, it may not be a problem today, and this 1,200 megawatts in and of itself may not provide an immediate cause for concern. However, if we get squeezed and we do need more electricity, and we decide we need more electricity from Hydro-Québec because they've got it, you know, at what point should we start to worry? I'm not sure that there's an easy answer to that question, but for a country that spent 40 years saying how important it is that we become energy independent, I would submit that being more dependent rather than less dependent on Quebec is probably not a direction we want to head. Will our New Hampshire consumers actually have any access to this power? The answer to that question today is no, and we're not going to be benefiting from any direct sale of this electricity in New Hampshire. Right now, it's all going into the southern New England area, and it's going into the wholesale marketplace, and the real need for power in that wholesale marketplace is south of New Hampshire. If Northeast Utilities does sell some of this power to PSNH, which they've been talking about, you know, do we even need it? Actually, PSNH does need power. They don't generate enough power to serve all of their customers. So in that sense, they need it. New Hampshire doesn't need it. And I would submit that before we spent $1 billion importing new power from Quebec, we might want to think about buying power from the 4 to 6 biomass plants that generate about 100 megawatts of power collectively that PSNH today refuses to even talk with. Those are New Hampshire jobs. Those are money. Those are dollars that are spent that stay in the state. It's a renewable energy source. And here we are possibly going to close them down. And then we're going to turn around and build a new power line from Quebec. I don't know. We talked about the jobs and the added tax revenues and about the reality that there are many other economic questions that need to be answered about this project that haven't been. You know, if we expect something like this to reduce our power electricity rates, I think we're being a little bit naive. I think it's a fair statement that there's very little likelihood that our electricity rates are going to go down. And we just need to accept that reality. If we can do things to minimize the rate of growth, that's a good thing. But I don't know too many people who are arguing that rates are going to go down. And we need to recognize that if we're going to talk about the positive economic benefits of a project like this, and I certainly wouldn't dismiss that even if there are 1,200 short-term jobs and a lot of them come from out of state, there definitely will be an impact, a positive economic impact from that. And there will be a positive economic impact if new property taxes are paid. I'm not sure that the benefit is worth that benefit is worth the cost, but we all have to come to that decision on our own. But one thing we need to recognize is that we need to understand what the property value impacts are actually going to be. We need to understand what the impacts in the tourism economy are going to be. And if there are going to be dislocations economically, it's much better for us to understand that up front rather than learn it after the fact. The environmental questions, I'll try to do this quickly, but you know, the power being renewable and green, there are a number of organizations, and the Forest Society is not among them, but there are a number of conservation organizations that are currently doing research on this subject. Yes, sir.
Would you know how many full-time permanent jobs will be created in the Franklin area?
I should know the answer to that question, but I don't. I don't think it's a lot. I honestly don't know, and all I do know is that when they talk about these 1,200 jobs that will be created, they're all temporary. But there will be some, you know, there's got to be some job creation, permanent job creation. It's a huge facility. It needs to be maintained. But I don't know enough about the specific question you asked to answer it. Will it reduce CO2 emissions by the 5 million tons that were suggested it would? I think this is very much open to question. I've not seen any documentation to support this. And they may have it. They've told us they're doing a report. We haven't seen it yet. Who decides whether the degradation of the New Hampshire landscape is an acceptable trade-off for this conduit of power going south? That's actually the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee. We'll get more into that in a second. The health issue, as I already mentioned, this is not an area where I have a lot of expertise, but if anybody's interested in more information, I actually do know a couple of people who've done a lot of work on this. The impacts on natural resources, there clearly are going to be forest fragmentation issues created by this. There are going to be, anytime you plant new towers in the ground, you obviously are going to have an ecological impact of some sort. How severe this is going to be remains to be determined. I think there's something like 1,100 of these towers over that 180 miles. So it isn't going to be an insignificant impact in aggregate. Are there alternatives for the transmission of this power that have less environmental impact? We talked about the existing right-of-way, which I think is at least something that needs to be studied more thoroughly. There's been some discussion about burying the line along existing transportation corridors. And to give you an idea, I mean, I'm going to make this sound simple, and I know it's not, and I think there are probably issues I don't understand about this. But, you know, I-91 runs directly from Montreal to Hartford, Connecticut. And if you can bury an underground cable that carries electricity, like the kind we're talking about here, and you can, would it make sense to bury this along a corridor of land that the government already owns? you know, that might be worth looking at. It might be worth looking at abandoned railroad rights of way that exist north and south in this state and in Vermont. So I think the point is here that we don't know whether there are any other reasonable alternatives, and it's because nobody has thoroughly looked at reasonable alternatives yet. But that's coming. And yeah. Oh, is the power green? Yeah, I mean, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. What's green to me may not be green to you. But the point here is there's a lot of dispute about, and I'll just take the carbon issue as one. There are a number of issues. But in order to be green from a carbon perspective, if you do an accounting of all, and you create debits for all of the negatives and you create credits for all of the positives, and you start from the beginning and you do a thorough accounting, there are many people who believe that the impact of flooding those 7 million acres of land actually creates an atmospheric deposition of greenhouse gases that, particularly in the short term, are very detrimental and add up significantly on the negative side of the ledger. So there would have to be a lot of savings on the positive side before you got to zero. And so there, I think the jury is still out on this, not that the research hasn't been done, but it's being accumulated by other scientists as we speak to try and understand, okay, when you do the full accounting, what does it really look like? And it's complicated, it really is. Ralph.
Well, let me just make a minor point. Northern Pass has never used the word green in connection with their proposal. They call it clean power.
Right.
Well, the Nuclear Energy Institute calls atomic power clean power, and there's a reason to question that right now. But the problem is in the definition. I don't think there is such a thing as clean power, unless maybe you're using an organic clothesline and using solar power to dry your organic clothes. That's about the limit of it. Once you start generating electricity, there is nothing clean. It's a question of how dirty do we get.
Point well taken, and I would argue that they actually do think this power is green, but not the way you and I think it's green. So, who decides on the degradation issue? I mentioned this, the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee. There are three or four major regulatory hurdles that the project has to clear. I think everybody in this room is probably familiar by now about this Department of Energy review that's going on. The National Environmental Policy Act requires the federal government to do what's called an environmental impact statement to look at all reasonable alternatives to try and get to what would be the least environmentally damaging alternative. Now, interestingly, the law doesn't require the project applicant or the Department of Energy to force the applicant to actually use the least damaging environmental alternative. It just requires that they study, you know, and identify what the least damaging alternative is. So just because they study this doesn't necessarily mean that's what we're going to get. And that's just one indicator of how this process and the state process that I'm going to talk about in a second, these processes are really designed to get to yes. They're not designed to independently weigh yes or no. And I think we have to be aware of that, because if we're not aware of it, we're only going to get surprised in the end. And I think the best way to make these processes work for us, and by that I mean everybody in the state, even the people who support the project, is to make darn sure that they do a thorough job of analyzing every reasonable alternative. The law does require that. And the law also requires that they study a no-build alternative. So they actually have to do an analysis of what would be the consequences if we didn't build this project. And if we require them to do that rigorously, then they're going to have to start addressing questions like, is the power really needed? So this process with the Department of Energy is already underway. Their own assessment at the Department of Energy is that it will be at least 1 year before the draft environmental impact statement is prepared. They held these scoping hearings. They take all of the comments that they receive from the hearings and from independently submitted comments from the public. They analyze all those comments, and then they make a decision based on those comments. What alternatives are we going to study? And I, from our perspective at the Forest Society and many of the other conservation organizations in New Hampshire, our biggest immediate fear is how they make that decision. How publicly do they make that decision? How much information are we going to have access to about how that decision is made? And I'm pleased to report that our congressional delegation has really weighed in on the process side here, and they're willing to carry the battle on this and make certain that the regulators at the federal level do a thorough job and plan a high bar in terms of the rigor with which they do this work. So that's the good news, and I think that's the most we can expect from this process is a really well-done alternatives analysis. And as I said before, you know, it doesn't guarantee that the ultimate decision is going to be one that we would prefer or that is, in fact, the least impacting environmental alternative, but at least it will get studied. And the reason that that's important is because the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee, which really decides whether this gets sited on the ground in New Hampshire or not, will use the analysis that's prepared by the Department of Energy in their EIS as part of the information on which they're going to make their decision about siting. So the state of New Hampshire is not likely to do a lot of independent economic analysis. We need to make certain that the DOE process does that analysis and that it can stand up to scrutiny. Another piece of decision making that has to happen is by the United States Department of Agriculture, to which the National Forest System is appended. And so our White Mountain National Forest here in New Hampshire is one of 155 national forests around the country, and they are managed, overseen by the Department of Agriculture. They have to issue what's called a special use permit for any power line use of national forest land. They presently are proposing to go through a power line that takes about 10 miles of existing right-of-way through the or special use permit area through the national forest. And interestingly, the federal government doesn't allow any private entity to acquire a perpetual easement for any purpose on federal land. That's a pretty unique concept, which I think we should explore in more detail. But the point is that they only allow term uses under these special use permits for federally owned land. And in order for this project to go through the National Forest, they will have to get a new special use permit. A fellow by the name of Tom Wagner is the forest supervisor, and he's the person in the United States Department of Agriculture who's been delegated to make this decision. And he will make the decision based on the environmental impact statement. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, also known as FERC, they actually have already approved what's called a transmission services agreement, which is a document that spells out the financial relationship between the partners. And if you're interested in really knowing how this whole deal works financially, I think it's only 790 pages, but the document itself isn't, that's all the appendices and all that. It's really not that bad. But it actually articulates, you know, the financial relationship between Hydro-Québec, Northern Pass, and the two principal partners of Northern Pass. And it's really interesting reading because, remember, Hydro-Québec is building this whole thing with their money. They're lending 50% of the project cost to Northeast Utilities and NSTAR, Northern Pass will actually charge a fee to Hydro-Québec for the use of this power line that Hydro-Québec is paying for, and they will get Northern Pass through this transmission services agreement will get a 12.5% rate of return on their investment of Hydro-Québec's money of $500 million. It's a sweet deal for the utilities.
Is this the same service agreement that the Public Utilities Commission has instructed for to look at again, because they said that 12.5% was way too sweet of a deal?
It is.
As Hydro-Québec is funding the project.
It is. And my understanding is that the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission has asked FERC to revisit this, as you just said. Yeah.
What is the status of the
filing for landowners and the state of New Hampshire regarding the real estate of these towers, which personally I believe should become underground. I believe the 65-foot tower should strengthen up and enhance the underground. What is our partnership with them owning the real estate? Or do we not have any right to that real estate once it's come into the name? Because they can shop the money all they want, but it's our real estate.
Well, you get the right to pay the taxes on your real estate.
How about charging them per kilowatt hour?
Well, I mean, you raise a really interesting idea. Sure.
I may have my facts wrong, or what I heard, but I understand that they offered the state of New Hampshire $20 million. Is that wrong or not?
Well, they said that I won't get the precise dollar amount here, but their argument is that the municipalities in the state of New Hampshire will receive property tax revenue by virtue of the value of what they're building on the ground in that town.
That's really nice of them to offer that. Now, what's our counter offer?
That's a good question. I mean,
this could be the Alaskan pipeline, but 130-foot towers is a non-starter.
It's really interesting that the Northern Pass gets to make money off a power line built on land that, for the most part, they don't even own. I mean, it's I know, I understand, and it's mind-boggling. Even the federal government, I was mentioning the special use permit through the National Forest. They get paid, the federal government gets paid an annual rental fee for that special use permit, and it's in part determined by how much electricity goes over the line. Well, if it's good enough for the federal government, why isn't it good enough for...
Is it negotiable from the beginning point right now? Right now is when our state, and I say legislators, but our state should be negotiating the proper terms. And again, I submit, underground, and that could be paid by the more efficient transmission lines that I believe technology has provided us. You know, saving 25% of what is lost right now, the buzz and the hum coming off of the lines, that could be paid over the next 40, 50, 60 years in energy savings. I suspect, I like you, are not an electrical engineer or transmission stuff.
Well, I think you're raising a really valid point, and I don't have an easy answer to the question of who do we negotiate with or how do we negotiate. I think that so far we've done a pretty good job for those of us who have been opposing this of saying, stop, wait a second, and maybe there's an opportunity. I mean, you're not going to hear me advocate that we should build this at any price. I just want you to know that. But I understand that if some landowners wanted to sit down with the power company and negotiate, you know, you're certainly free to do that. Will the state of New Hampshire do that for you? I don't think so. And maybe it's worth talking to your elected officials. Well, there you go. There you go. Yeah, Ralph?
Let me comment on this point in respect to the last Hydro-Quebec interconnect line that came through. That's now been upgraded to 2,200 megawatts. It was back in the 80s when they produced an EIS for that line, and we went to what was then the Bulk Power Site Evaluation Committee, which is composed of state agency heads and their designees, all of whom answer to the governor. At that time, all they were interested in, despite the EIS and all the other testimony, was the fact that New Hampshire was going to get $500,000 in taxes to the state, basically business profits taxes, and they approved the line that we now have. So don't look for the state to be protecting your interests when the state has its own interests. That's number one. Number two, if you want to try and negotiate with the power companies over the terms of their right-of-way, be my guest, but if it's already in your deed that they have an easement, they're not going to get very far.
Thanks, Ralph. The the fourth of four major regulatory reviews will only happen if PSNH decides to enter into a purchase power agreement with directly with Hydro-Québec. And in that case, that purchase power agreement would have to be approved by the Public Utilities Commission. It's kind of an interesting situation because they'd actually be negotiating with themselves for this agreement. And, you know, they've been talking about this for 3 or 4 years and they still haven't come to an understanding. But we'll see what happens. This was actually one of the DOE hearings, I think, up at Haverhill. I don't know if anybody was there, but about 300 people. This is a picture of the existing right-of-way that we've been talking about. It's actually taken in Dunbarton, New Hampshire. You see there's actually three different power lines here. There's two alternating current lines on the side, and then there's the DC power line that we've just been talking about. This power line, I think that tower is about 90 feet tall, and that open space there is about 225 feet wide. But that's, you know, the kinds of concerns that we have as the Forest Society on our forests are that some people say that that's new habitat, and yeah, it is a very expensive way to get it, but it's also a bifurcation of the forest that has fairly significant ecological consequences. This is a picture of the same power line in Haverhill where it crosses 116. This is a really beautiful farm. It's kind of the gateway into Pittsburgh along the Connecticut River where the Indian Stream comes into the Connecticut River. It's called the Indian Stream Farm. It's owned by a guy named John Amy. And this farm, fortunately, recently they identified a primary corridor that's to the south of this farm, so they might see it, but not significantly. An alternative route that they've identified, and it's somewhat which route they use is somewhat dependent on decisions made by Hydro-Québec north of the border, because it's right over the hill here. But there's one alternative that would come down right around the farm, and that farm, the view of that farm would be absolutely decimated if that were to happen. And these are some of the issues that, as an organization, we have all the way up and down the line. It isn't just new corridor that we're concerned about. It's the impact of these tall towers on our entire visual landscape. This is a snapshot of from our property at the Rocks Estate in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, where we own 1,400 acres of land. There's an existing right-of-way that goes about 1.3 miles through the property. This is actually north of our property, and I put this in here because I don't know if you can see this string of power line right here. Those power lines are about 45 feet high, and if they get elevated to 90 feet or 135 feet, you're going to see that on the landscape where you don't, you see this from a higher elevation now. When you're driving on the roads in Bethlehem, those towers are shorter than the trees. The new towers won't be. And that will have a dramatic impact on that visual landscape. So what's the Forest Society doing? We have a number of conservation organization partners that we're working with: the Appalachian Mountain Club, the Conservation Law Foundation, the Nature Conservancy, the Amonoosuc Conservation Trust, three of the regional planning commissions that are in the area of the power line. We're spending a lot of our time reaching out to inform people about this and making certain that we organize collectively so that we actually have a voice. I think it's safe to say that if all of us who really care about this just sit on our hands, this thing's going to happen. If we don't sit on our hands, if we stand up and make our voices heard, I believe this thing can be stopped. I'm not convinced yet that we can prevent Hydro-Québec from importing power to southern New England, but I'm pretty convinced that we can stop it from coming through New Hampshire on overhead lines, or even buried lines for that matter. But this alternatives analysis is about to get underway, and as I said earlier, if we can just make sure that that's rigorous, that will be a huge benefit for the state as we contemplate these regulatory decisions that need to be made. I pretty much talked about these, our core goals as an organization. You know, one thing I haven't mentioned is that in the 31 towns that are directly impacted by the preferred corridor, The Forest Society actually owns 18 different forest reservations of about 5,600 acres, and we hold 89 conservation easements of over 19,000 acres. That's just us. The state and the federal government own conservation lands. Other conservation organizations own conservation lands. And we conserve these lands specifically to prevent the kind of uses that this project proposes to make. And I don't want to say that this project is going to negatively impact every one of those properties. That's not the case. But there are a number of them that will be impacted. And one of the things that really concerns us is the scenic impact on the communities. And it isn't just the economic values that are at stake. Those are significant. But a lot of people choose to live here because of this landscape. And to start ripping it up is really an affront. This is an ad we put in the paper a couple of weeks ago, and our position now is to these companies, look, I think you guys have heard the people of New Hampshire. This is not something that's desired. Go back to the drawing board and come back with Plan B. And that's basically the position that we've been articulating. What's happening now, the DOE today, April 12th, is actually the date at which originally that was the deadline for comments to the Department of Energy's scoping process. It so happens that I haven't seen this in writing anywhere, but our congressional delegation has informed us and others that the Department of Energy has agreed to a 60-day extension of that comment period. And my understanding is, and Susan, I think I read something from you, that it was the 15th of June?
I saw this just before I came down, but on the Oregon Pass DOE website, they said that they were going to the DOE is expecting a 60-day extension. What they're waiting for is we have to be published in the Federal Register first, and then the bureaucracy upon bureaucracy. They expect that notice will be published on Friday, April 15th. And then you do another 2 months. And they are accepting comments right through this whole period until the extension starts. So, right away.
Thank you. The other immediate issue that I think all of us can have an impact on, there's a piece of legislation that's been introduced in the Hampshire legislature. It passed the House last week or 2 weeks ago by a vote of 317-51. And basically, this project or this bill would put boundaries on the use of eminent domain by a transmission project like this that doesn't have either a demonstrated need or a system reliability need that's been identified, neither of which this has. And if the bill is going to be heard by the Senate Judiciary Committee sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I think it's really important for everybody who cares about this issue to communicate with your state senator. I actually have a list up here if anybody wants mailing addresses and phone numbers of all 24 senators. I think New Hampton Senator is Jeanie Forrester, who's the only senator who's co-sponsored this legislation, which means there are 23 others that will vote on it besides her. And I think 5 have so far said they will vote for it. I've only heard one who's definitely voting against it. So the opportunity is now to weigh in on this and either thank Jeanie Forrester for introducing it or write others you might know on the list and ask them to oppose it. But the bottom line here is if this bill passes, it will be incredibly harder for Northern Pass to use eminent domain to secure the new rights of way that they need, or for that matter, to widen existing rights of way that they may need. So what to do? Commenting on the DOE scoping invitation, I'll put an email address up here in a second, but you don't have to be an expert to make a comment. You can go to their website. You can electronically make a comment. What they're really interested in is what's your opinion of the alternatives analysis they should do. And if you think they should just study the no-build option and leave it at that, then say that. If you think that they should study burying it in the Connecticut River, I'm not advocating that, but if you think that that's a good idea, then tell them that. I think it's important to tell them something in addition to, I'm opposed to this. It's important to tell, to give them some framework that they can use in their analysis. We talked about contacting the senators. If you want the contact information, see me afterwards. I would recommend the best 44 cents that you'll spend in the next week is writing a personally handwritten note to Governor Lynch. And let me tell you why I think that's important. There are two reasons. One, so far he's supporting this project, and he needs to hear from people who don't support it. That's simple. The other thing is that while he might not be able to stop the project by issuing an executive order, he has the bully pulpit. And as governor, if he stood up and said, I've decided that after listening to the people of New Hampshire that this just isn't good for the state, I think that's the one way to put the final nail in the coffin. So empower him, you know, give him a reason to change his mind. And there's precedent for this. 30 years ago, 25 years ago, Hugh Gallon was governor when the first project that Ralph was talking about was proposed. It was actually proposed to come through Coos County, and Governor Gallon supported that. And he got so much flack from so many constituents that he changed his mind. And because he changed his mind, he helped affect the outcome, which was to keep the project in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, and it went through Western New Hampshire, and it went along an existing right-of-way. That power line already existed, so there wasn't, to my knowledge anyway, there wasn't any need for eminent domain then, because all they did was put that new tall tower in between two existing alternating current lines. So writing the governor, great investment of 44 cents. And finally, this is something that I first heard from Susan, which I think is, you know, if you're looking for a message to send to the governor, this is a great one. Tell him that you've decided that we need to redefine NIMBY. It's not in my backyard, but New Hampshire is my backyard, and we need to protect it. Thank you all very much.